Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to the first in a series of podcasts where I am joined, I'm delighted to say, by my co-host, Michael Cow. The urban cowboy himself is joining me as we try and bring some kind of order to a disorderly world. So, Michael, welcome to this. I mean, who knows where this is going to go?
Oh, gosh, thank you. I'm so excited about this JV with you. I've been personally interested in the intersection of macroeconomics and geopolitics for some time. And I believe it's a topic that is becoming more and more important in today's increasingly disorderly world, as you just referred to, right? And as an investor, I think that you can't really adequately assess macroeconomic risks without considering geopolitics. But then, as my recent collaboration with Mike St. Pierre at West Point showed, you also need to highlight the importance of macroeconomics to the world of the military. And I think that's what our podcast aims to do.
Well, you've been kind of on this journey for a while now. Talk a little bit about how you tumbled into this particular geopolitical, military, strategic rabbit hole, because you're down there pretty deep, my friend.
Well, in 2021, actually, it goes all the way back to 2019, but a friend of mine that I grew up with as a U.S. Army colonel, he invited me to participate. He was a professor at the U.S. Army War College. And for those of you who don't know, the U.S. Army War College is really a master's in strategic studies program for the officer corps. And every year, at the end of their term, they have a capstone event called the National Security Seminar, in which they invite a couple of civilians in private business to join in on conversations. And because of COVID, I got put off and I finally participated via Zoom. I wish it had been in person, but I participated in one of these seminars in 2021. And I found it so rewarding because I actually felt that I could add some value. You know, in military circles, they talk a lot about the pillars of national power. They talk about, you know, the diplomatic, the informational, the military, and the economic, but they willingly accede that they don't know or teach that much about the economic part of it. And so that was a very fruitful discussion. I tweeted about it. And then Mike St. Pierre, who is our debut guest today, found me that way.
That's the perfect way to set up our guest, because we do have a guest joining us. And we'll get Mike to introduce himself, because knowing him and knowing his resume, there is no way you or I could do it justice, neither in length or scope or in any way understanding or remembering half of the three-letter acronyms that we're no doubt going to get thrown at us once he goes through his impressive resume.
No doubt.
So before we bring Mike on, let's talk a little bit about what you're hoping to get out of this conversation and what you're hoping to either uncover or help people understand better, because I think that's really one of the most important parts of this.
So the collaboration that I had with Mike was a paper entitled U.S. Dollar Primacy in an Era of Economic Warfare. We presented this, we co-wrote this and co-presented it at West Point in February. And our joint hope on that paper was to highlight certain, I guess, glaring holes in national security policy. And we focused on the economic. And so what my hope for this podcast series is to continually explore this intersection from various standpoints. Maybe sometimes we might have guests that are more on the economic realm, and sometimes we might have guests that are more on the military realm. And I think that, you know, today's guest, Mike St. Pierre, is a perfect way to start off because he straddles both. His background obviously comes more from the military realm, but he's one of the very few that I've experienced in that realm that has a very active focus on the macroeconomic part of it as well.
Well, that's the perfect setup. So why don't we bring Mike in and get chatting?
Well, without further ado, I want to introduce my collaborator on this West Point project that we did a couple of months ago. This is Lieutenant Commander Mike St. Pierre of the Royal Canadian Navy. Mike reached out to me and said, hey, would you like to collaborate on a potential paper together? And we worked very hard. Mike taught me everything there was to know about Chicago-style footnoting. I feel like I haven't done that kind of thing in decades, but here we are. So, Mike, welcome to the show. And this is our debut episode of the show. So I thought it'd be a great place for us to start. And maybe you can introduce yourself and tell us about your background.
Sure. MK Ultra, which will be easier than batting back and forth. Mike, you shall be known as MK Ultra. And Grant, great to speak with you today. Great opportunity and obviously a fan of your work for some years now, Grant. So, thank you very much for speaking today. Before I get into anything, I just want to let you know that my views expressed today do not reflect the Canadian Armed Forces, Department of National Defense, or the Government of Canada. That being said, the Canadian Armed Forces and Canadian Forces College Toronto, where I'm now studying, been exceptionally supportive of my work and, allowing me to collaborate with Mike down in West Point and attend conferences and sort of explore something that's outside of what has traditionally been strategic studies, let's say. I think it used to, it definitely was, but it's been something we've been missing. So my brief background is I've been in the Air Forces for 23 years now. No one's counting, but joined up at 17, went to Royal Military College of Canada in Kingston, did a degree in strategic studies. So everything sort of grounded in the realist realm. So all your classical thinkers, whether, politics or geopolitics and the study of war, essentially. Following that, I joined the fleet on the West Coast out of Esquimalt and sailed on frigates. And then I got the bug for diving and joined the clearance diving and bomb disposal unit out there, which took me all over the world. Spent much time in the U.S. training with brothers down in Florida, and then had the opportunity to travel to a number of NATO countries, the Five Eyes, so Australia, British Canada, New Zealand, and did 3 years in Portsmouth doing domestic bomb disposal with the lads out of Pompey. Great exposure there. And then luckily enough, the CAF funded a one-year master's at IDC Herzliya in Israel, just north of Tel Aviv, now known as Reichman University, and focused on, at the time, obviously, everyone was focused on counterterrorism, global war on terror in the Middle East. So I got a real taste of hardcore realism at IDC Herzliya and got my taste for oil and gas markets, focused specifically on the risks to geopolitics, macroeconomics with the Straits of Hormuz. That was sort of on the radar at the time. Returned from the UK in 2017, joined the Pacific Coast as XO, and then posted to an HQ. So I spent, 15 years of my life in the tactical realm focused on the nuts and bolts. And it hit when I was on parade in Wuhan, China, in October of 2019, saluting Chairman Xi, and realized there's something amiss here. Came back, and shortly thereafter, I don't know, you may have heard of this city, things changed very rapidly. I felt it acutely with my experience there just on the ground and what happened subsequently. And something from my bomb disposal background, there's only so long you want to spend in your youth poking bombs. And I thought, maybe I should transition to something a bit more mature as I age and get gray hair. And one thing that's missing, at least from the tactical level, and we're seeing it, in macroeconomics and geopolitics as well, is, what we realize when you're targeting a terror network is you want to go after the money. The concept is a model, F3EAD, find, fix, finish, exploit, analyze, disseminate. And part of that targeting cycle, you can imagine what the finish looks like, but is identifying the financial flows that are funding the network. And then you can really target the heartbeat of this network. So looking at what happened with both the rise of China and the subsequent massive monetary stimulus, I thought, okay, how does this work? What am I missing? And luckily enough, within the headquarters, there wasn't much bomb disposal going on in the midst of a massive pandemic. And I knew that I would be loaded onto our command and staff college. This is where sort of you finish your tactical time and then you go up to the operational level and you're educated at the strategic level. And I thought this is a great opportunity to get ahead of the curve and start working on a thesis well ahead of my mates. And why not take the opportunity and started looking into money and following the money. So just taking that simple model, most models are wrong, but some are useful, but applying it to sort of the macroeconomic and where those links between macro, strategic studies, geopolitics combine. I was lucky enough to find you, Grant, and you gave a wonderful briefing to some strategic study students and practitioners in Canada almost, what is it, 3 years ago now? But that's where I'm at now. And I think, you know, having found MKUltra, you know, there's so few that look at, you know, finance is about obviously making money. Let's leave that as it is. But the security studies side sort of has left the free market to its own devices, however you want to define that. But it's the link between the two that I think there's something missing. And I saw that Michael Cao was lecturing at U.S. Army War College. And I thought, well, I'm going to reach out to him and see what happens. And, you know, I think we were able to put together a decent product and hopefully something to tease out today.
Well, it makes mine and Michael's CVs look ridiculous in comparison. You know, I spent a few years here sitting at a desk and doing this. I can honestly say I've never defused a bomb, nor have I planted one. I've thrown myself on a few grenades for colleagues before, but that was metaphorically rather than more than physically. But let's talk about, you know, the two of you came together and, you know, it's this idea of geopolitics and finance being a critical nexus point now is so true. And I think more and more people are becoming aware of that. So Michael, let's talk a little bit about when the, actually, I'm going to have to start calling you MKUltra, aren't I? There's too many Michaels on this thing. So MKUltra, let's talk about the paper. Let's talk about the genesis of it and what the two of you guys set out to try and discuss. Never mind the conclusions you reached, we'll come to those in a bit. But what did you set out to try and analyze and discuss?
Yeah, so the U.S. Army War College experience that MSP, I'm going to call Mike St. Pierre MSP.
Okay.
that MSP referred to was every year, U.S. Army War College hosts this thing called the National Security Seminar. It's kind of like the capstone event for their officer corps grads in that program to associate with, you know, people in business, civilians, to get a different point of view. And it was very interesting to me because this was 2021 that I participated in that. And I remember asking at the time, is Taiwan considered a vital interest to the United States? And I wouldn't say it was an attitude of nonchalance, but it was more that there wasn't that much appreciation for the economic importance of Taiwan Semiconductor. And I remember bringing it up at the time saying, wow, I would think that Taiwan Semiconductor alone, given its importance in the supply chain of global chips, makes it a vital interest. And so that's what I think tweeted about and MSP noted about it. And we covered that in our paper. The gist of our paper was, we called it U.S. dollar primacy in an era of economic warfare. And the very gist of it, as Grant, you and I talked about, is that U.S. and China are in a great power competition. And there are certain ways to handle an adversary that's of much bigger size than you. And I almost like to use this analogy of judo, right? The characters of judo in Chinese and also in Japanese, they use the same characters, are rou dao. And rou dao, what that means is yielding way. It's the yielding way. So the idea behind our paper is, look, rather than do what we did against Russia and charge an adversary headlong with financial sanctions that only serve to drive other countries to look for alternatives to the US dollar system that has served our country so well for decades, right? Why not, first of all, find ways to defend our flank through proper industrial policy? And we talk about the discontinuities between energy policy and semiconductor policy. But then also, look, China is the most indebted country in the world, and they're very, very exposed to a strong dollar. And so the idea is that financial judo, we have a domestic inflation fight right now. The Fed naturally needs to keep the dollar strong. And literally that in and of itself, we're advocating against weaponization of the dollar, but a naturally occurring strong dollar exchange rate actually has the potential to cause some financial disarray for our largest geopolitical adversary. Mike, would you say that that's an accurate representation?
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head is recognizing the power structures as they are. And something that we didn't bring up, and I hesitate to bring it up right now live, but what about the domestic problems as well? You know, how do we have something that balances domestic U.S. interests with its allies and challenges its foes? without being overt, as MKUltra just raised, the confiscation of Russian treasuries, it's very easy to get into the doomsayer end of the US dollar. I think there's problems. There's no doubt about it. But when you recognize the nature of the system and appreciate it for what it is, how do you do so effectively by maintaining hegemony? And I think how we came out with recommending a strong dollar policy is the best case of a lot of worse options out there.
Well, let's actually talk about this right off the bat, because this is going to be a conversation that's fundamental to wherever this goes, and that is the dollar and this discussion about the end of the dollar. And as Michael, you pointed out, weaponizing it and charging headlong into Russia, I think was a catastrophic mistake. And I think it's already kind of set wheels in motion that now the US doesn't necessarily have control over where they go. But let's find the distinction between the end of dollar hegemony and a decline in people's willingness to hold dollar reserve assets. Let's get the currency and asset argument out of the way.
If I could push back a little bit on the premise that it's set forth an irreversible trend, I'm going to push back on that.
Oh, no, I didn't say irreversible. I said it's going to go in directions that we don't know where it's going to go. I think that's...
Yeah. But I'm just going to say that, look, I've written at length about this online and Twitter and Substack, and I wrote a piece called Bricks of BRAC. Kind of like a play on words, right? And because there's so much talk about how, oh my gosh, you know, the BRICS nations are going to come forth and, you know, blah, blah, blah. One of the things that we talk about a lot in our paper is that the attractiveness of the dollar came about organically. It's not as if it was a top-down mandate on the world. The world started choosing through this proliferation of Eurodollar deposits in the 1950s, long before the so-called Nixon shock of 1971, the abandonment of gold convertibility, right? And so ultimately, the first part of our paper talks about, well, what confers that trust? What confers the trust in the US dollar? And there's so many things go into that. We hone in on a couple of pillars of national power. You know, we talk about the importance of geography. We talk about the importance of industrial capacity. And we talk about the importance of natural resources. But of course, military strength, the rule of law, all of these things are ingredients, right? And to your point, Grant, you're exactly right. The overt weaponization of the dollar by seizing reserves, that is something that we are advocating against in our paper because that actively undermined that trust. But I will say that the point of my Bricks of BRAC piece was to show that, look, if you think the US so bad, who is out there that can garner a bigger sense of trust? And when you consider, let's just take BRICS, right? Because that's an easy one because that's what everybody talks about. Brazil, no. I mean, Russia, absolutely not. India is an up-and-coming power. But see, I wrote a tweet a while ago, and I hope it doesn't offend people, but this is what I said. I said, look, let's look at BRICS. R and I don't like each other anymore. I and C have never liked each other, okay? R and C are only in a tryst of convenience right now because of the war. But look, memories run deep. Putin doesn't like to be beholden to Xi as he is now. And Xi has memories of Mao being beholden to Stalin. So R and C are naturally adversaries. So that all that's left is BS.
Yeah, well, I read that, Mike. I thought it was absolutely perfect. But there are always these periods where the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? And so we're seeing that now with India and Russia's oil deals. We're seeing that now with Russia and China. And there will be times, and this is why I think it was so foolish to do what they did with those reserves, is you're forcing these guys that have a natural antipathy towards each other together. You're forcing them into an alliance that neither of them really wants. But it's kind of better than relying on the US if they're going to go down this path.
Yeah, that's right. No disagreement there. The question is the alternatives, right? And currently there are a lack of alternatives. And when you look at China, right, who is the, I guess, the front runner, you look at their track record of how they financed One Belt, One Road, the so-called, you know, debt diplomacy that they've used against a lot of countries, you know, in Asia and in Africa. You know, you look at China's vulnerabilities when we talk about energy. Actually, Mike MSP raised a great point about energy, right? And how you came face to face with the importance of energy security. Well, You want to talk about one of the most energy insecure countries in the world, that's China, because 80% of their oil imports go through the Strait of Malacca. They've tried to hedge those to really no avail.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously the answer, unfortunately for them, is to put their fate in the hands of Russia and try and negotiate a pipeline going north, right, that doesn't require any seabound transport. But that's a way off. But MSP, let's talk about the military aspects to this, because I think for us in the finance world, we're very sheltered in that everything, as you said, focuses around the financial aspects of it. And we kind of sit in the middle of that looking out, and we bring in geopolitics, and we bring in strategic conflicts, and we bring in all these things. But we assume that nobody outside our world really understands the importance of finance to their worlds, you know, because it's kind of almost deliberately made that way. It's made just opaque enough that it's complicated for people to understand. Otherwise, they realize what a racket the whole thing is. So let's flip over to your side of things and understand that when the light bulb went off for you and you realized that money was at the center of all this, what was the reaction from your peers when you started talking about this stuff? Was it a willingness to engage, or was it, well, this is all too hard, and how can money be as important as what we're doing here in terms of the military side of things?
One of the first people I reached out to was a current professor at Royal Military College, and I've been privileged to a very decent education. I said, why is this not taught at War College or the military colleges? And his conclusion was that it's a feature, not a bug. He had attempted to bring it into the curriculum with courses on international political economy. We had long discussions on, you know, the nature of international finance and where things have run down the track, and the consequences both domestically and abroad. There is a willingness to sort of get into it, but it is so opaque and we've become so siloed. There is an attempt to have more interdisciplinary studies. But, you know, how do you do international political economy without understanding monetary policy? And on top of, you know, how do you maintain currency and competency in your primary task, which is generally, you know, crunchy. And some of my colleagues will hate the fact that I'm going to raise Clausewitz. But, you know, if war is an extension of politics, and then you realize that politics is largely about money, then it gets very risky as, you know, uniformed officers to discuss issues like foreign interference, hybrid war, cognitive warfare, you know, Ben Hunt and the narrative game, you know, these types of issues when you start, because militarily right now, you know, yes, we can talk about kinetic operations and, you know, Mike and I have gotten into a lot of discussions on, you know, the nature of Taiwan. I think we should probably touch on that as, you know, the next sort of boat that may rock. Obviously, there's tons of discussions out there, but, you know, where does that intersection happen on dollar and geopolitics? All that said, the nature of war is always changing. One of the biggest light bulbs was, you know, tracking foreign interference, tracking, you know, elite capture, or what, you know, what the Taiwanese have termed as, you know, sharp power, the deliberate targeting within domestic populations of, you know, shifting behaviors at higher levels. So within the military, there's definitely an awareness. It is, you know, discussed at staff college, but it is very, very opaque. And when you're dealing with a problem set the size of a Russia, China, BRICS combined, you know, what does that do to the free market, and how does the military sort of, you know, enter into this? The diplomatic corps is for, you know, over 20 years now, in a number of countries, has been doors wide open. Anything that you could do to sort of open the doors to China has been, you know, the MO, and, you know, the ship of state turns very slowly. So how does that then, you know, close off, you know, foreign interference laws, tracking Chinese police stations, elite political capture at municipal, provincial, federal. So it's not just kinetic hard power. I think that is a huge conversation. We're seeing, you know, announcements daily, if not weekly, on alliance formation, investments into new hard power issues. But where that goes forward, it's a domestic problem and a foreign problem. And I don't think anyone has it figured out yet.
By the way, I want to mention that when I first met MSP, the military, including Mike, they like to use a lot of acronyms. And he threw so many acronyms at me that I'm like, wait, what does this mean? What does GWAT mean? Right? But what you just said about the relative inattention that the role of money is played, I'm not a spokesperson for the U.S. Army War College, but I will say that in my experience with that national security seminar, a bunch of the professors leading those sessions taught me this acronym called DIME. Right, it's the DIME framework is what they teach in terms of like the four elements of a national power: diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. And they readily acknowledge that they're very, very good at teaching the DIM part, but not as much on the E part. So I guess, Mike, you kind of agree that that's also endemic in your institution somewhat.
It is. Well, now you know what it feels like to be an outsider trying to figure out the world of finance.
Right. I think this is my point. This is my point, you know, because the E part of that is something that you haven't had to teach for 70 years because there's largely been cooperation on the economic side of things. And I guess that's a big part of this, right? Because we're at the point where you can argue whether this particular economic system and whether you decide that's globalism or capitalism or whatever it might be, you can argue whether it's reached the end of its useful life or not, but it's definitely, you know, heading that way and it's creaking at the seams. And that's why I think a lot of these things are coming up. But you know, MSP, you know, you talked about Taiwan there. And Mike Cao, I want to come back to something you said at the beginning when you talked about, because we may as well go there now because it's such an important part of this. And I'm curious as to when you think about Taiwan's importance, and you talked about its importance in that opening stanza of yours, is its importance financial, political, or geopolitical? Because those three things are starting to kind of come apart now. They used to kind of, you throw them all in together, but we've got this geopolitical struggle going on around Taiwan, but it becomes a very political, i.e. a domestic problem potentially. So how do you see Taiwan as a problem being looked at by all the various people who are looking at it?
Sure. I'm going to say it is all three. Absolutely all three. Because TSMC we all know about, right? And, you know, just for throw some stats out there, TSMC produces something like 90% of, quote, advanced chips out there and accounts for 50% of global foundry capacity. Right. So that's critical. That's critical.
Well, and UMC is about 40% of the rest, right?
Yeah, exactly. But geopolitically, right, I hosted this event a little over a week ago that Mike came to. The topic, of course, was US-China. And Peter Zeihan spoke at it and he put up this incredible map that was great because it's the world as China sees it. It's not like the regular map that's oriented north-south. World as China sees it, I believe his headline was China is hemmed in because you look at the way China looks around its land borders, aside from Russia, which we talked about is in a current tryst of convenience, let's say, they're all borders with not so friendlies. But then you look at outside as it looks through the South China Sea and the first island chain, they are essentially allies of the West and unfriendlies to China. And so Taiwan sits right dead smack in the middle of that first island chain. And you think about all of China's naval clashes and the Spratlys, the Paracels with all these countries, it's because they are not able to project force outside of that first island chain. They might have, I like to use the term, you know, sort of green water superiority, where they've got more vessels than, say, the U.S. Navy, but they can't really break out of that first island chain. So if Taiwan were to wind up in the hands of the CCP, it gives them a gigantic unsinkable aircraft carrier. But Mike is the Navy guy and the military guy, so I'd love to hear your assessment of that.
Well, I mean, the tough part in unpacking Taiwan is, I mean, this is where great power conflicts can go very sideways with the speed of escalation that we're talking about right now. You just think back to when Russia invaded Ukraine, how we were talking about, you know, border incursions, and then very quickly people start discussing thermonuclear weapons. Not to say that it's going there, but when great powers collide, you're talking about massive power shifts everywhere from space, cyber, and the boundaries between domestic and abroad, I think, are closed very quickly. On Taiwan specifically, you know, you brought up what is the most important. Mike brought up chips. Okay, sure, chips. Let's leave that aside. We're well aware of that. And actions are being taken. A lot of, you know, geostrategists will point to Taiwan being part of the first island chain and that would provide breakout. And then on top of that, it's where is the line for the US? We hear a lot of discussion on whether the unipolar era is over. If we're into a multipolar era, where is that line? Strikingly, Ukraine is still a question mark on how that is settled. But what happens forward? Where does the quote unquote rules-based order, and I'll leave that for one's own definition, where is that drawn? But Michael Cao actually shared a paper about this time last year that the Fed put out, and it was called the Imperial Dollar. And I thought it very interesting in that, you know, the Fed puts this document out, a brilliant piece, great research, but it focused only on the money, and that the U.S.'s preeminence will be forevermore, without question, based on this statement. And you can You dig it up. I think it's page 16. Asia will always need a place to park their savings.
That's right.
That's wonderful. But if there's a growing assertive power in Asia, and we know that the center of sort of, you know, Mackinder's map, that most financial flows are from Asia, then a break in that confidence gain, something of the order of Taiwan, although it may not have to be there right now. I just thought it was a little bit of hubris and purely focused on the money. Sure, that is the case, and I think it is. But as these challengers rise, and we don't know where the next challenge is going to come from, Taiwan is a huge one, but there will be others without question as the challengers rise. Getting back to Taiwan specifically, I was lucky enough to have a short fellowship for 3 weeks just last month, staying at National Defense University and conducted about 36 interviews. What I was really caught with was here in the West, we look at Taiwan as a cohesive, you know, cohesive body in much of the press. I hope that is the case. I saw a lot of, you know, very positive pro-democracy speakers and military theorists that were, you know, adamant that, you know, Taiwan is its own independent state. And that's wonderful. What we don't get is the nuance of the Republic of China, the history of the KMT, and concerns that where is U.S. foreign policy? Where is it now? Where will it be in 5 years if there's a different administration? And we've seen how boats can rock within administrations to administration. And is America willing to actually, you know, fight to protect it? Speakers within, you know, those circles in Taiwan are sort of portraying the KMT as the peace party. So in a bid for peace, how does that look? So we always think of, you know, kinetic operations, carrier battle groups, hypersonic missiles. What are the flashpoints of this? Discussing, you know, patching runways in Guam for second strike or third strike conventional capability. That's wonderful. But if we're talking about multi-domain hybrid war, there are so many other options for something to shift. That's my greatest concern.
I want to chime in on this topic real quick, because 2 years ago, I wrote a thread after having a conversation with, and I put in air quotes, uncle of mine. You know, in the Chinese culture, a friend of a friend, everybody's an uncle and an aunt, right? So my own parents are from China, and they emigrated over to Taiwan during that 1949 exodus with the KMT. So I remember growing up always hearing about the horror stories of the CCP, the atrocities that the CCP committed, et cetera. So I always assumed that there was this inbred enmity between the KMT and the CCP. So imagine my surprise when my air quote uncle was telling me, and he served with the KMT. I asked him, what do you think about China invading Taiwan? He goes, what do you mean? We'd welcome them with open arms. I'm like, wait, what? What are you talking about? And he basically said that, oh, yeah, I mean, look, the DPP, the Democratic People's Party, that pro-independence party, is the younger subset. They want to disassociate themselves with them being ethnically Chinese and would rather declare themselves independent and pivot to Japan. Whereas the old guard, the KMT, they really have this strong sense of Chinese ethnicity. And at least this view expressed was that we would rather keep our Chinese ethnicity than be independent. And so I actually, you know, at this event that Mike and I were at about a week ago, I actually posed this question. Mike is exactly right. Everybody is wargaming amphibious assaults and all this type of stuff. And I actually put out a tweet a couple of days ago saying, I actually think my biggest gray rhino risk, geopolitical risk, is a bloodless coup slash peaceful reunification scenario. And don't get me wrong. Some people immediately, you know how Twitter is, immediately accuse me of being a warmonger. No, not at all. That's totally a twisting of my words. I'm very, very concerned that given Taiwan's geopolitical importance in that strait, economically, geopolitically, I guess just imagine a CCP-controlled Taiwan, how dangerous that would be to all of its enemies and to the entire, you know, rules-based order that MSP talked about. And I'll just end my little anecdote with, I really think that the greatest threat to U.S. dollar hegemony is geopolitical. It would be a scenario where, let's say, Taiwan is allowed to go back to the CCP. To me, that would greatly undermine the trust in the dollar-based system, because I think the world would rightly perceive that if the U.S. is going to let Taiwan go, then what will Japan think? What will the Philippines think? What will, you know, Australia think? What will all of the countries in that region think? And if you think about back to the Weimar Republic and that hyperinflation, the bottom didn't fall out of the Reichsmark until France invaded the Ruhr Valley. It was a geopolitical catalyst that basically really made trust crater in that currency. So I think it's so critical.
Well, let's follow that through, because there's so much in there to unpack. This idea of trust in a currency is so important. I mean, let's face it, every currency in the world today is built on trust and nothing else, and nothing else backing it other than trust. But you have to trust in the people who are issuing it, which becomes more problematic every day. You have to trust in people's willingness to accept it. And so when you talk about Taiwan, I think this is why I want to come back to this idea of distinguishing between the type of problems that Taiwan is, because there is this geopolitical problem, as you said, Michael. And then if it came to any kind of military action, it then becomes, particularly in America, I would think, a very, very domestic political problem. Because obviously we've been through Vietnam, we've been through Iraq, we've been through Afghanistan, and here we are in another foreign war in a country that I would think most Americans couldn't find on a map. It's tiny, and it's not in the bad neighborhood of the Middle East, which sometimes brings it onto the news. But how do you then justify fighting a war? Because, you know, you're going to talk about it being over chips, but for a lot of people, they're going to say, hey, what about Intel? What about Micron? What about AMD in Europe? What about all these alternatives? This doesn't make any sense to us, unless they have an understanding of the global foundry industry, Michael, which is unlikely. So then you come back to the same problem. If the Chinese and the Taiwanese achieve some kind of peaceful reconciliation, and like you, Mike, I think the chance of that is absolutely not zero. And as soon as it's not zero, you have to kind of think it through. So let's think that through. There was a poll released this week, Nikkei poll, I think it was, and saying that 53% of Chinese nationalists would like to be reunified with Taiwan. But there are also, as you said, rising numbers of people in Taiwan that wouldn't be anti a reunification between Taiwan and China, particularly if the choice is a peaceful one or a military one. So MSP, how is that in the militaries, how are their thoughts shifting around how a reunification might take place and the fact that it might not be a military one? And if so, how does that shift the military picture of Asia if there were to be a reconciliation?
I mean, I can't speak on behalf of any of my colleagues. I mean, Michael Cao's seen it and we've all seen it. Depending on the circles, it's typically a focus on kinetic options, and it will be a political choice at the time, pending certain decisions made in Washington, and then allies will then either choose to get on board or not. And who knows what those consequences are. Within Taiwan, I got the impression that even within the military there, there's a split. Civil society, the young want Taiwanese independence, the old and many of the power brokers, I don't think, are opposed to a quote unquote peaceful reunification. But I'm just going to bring it back to, you know, what does this do for U.S. domestic political stability and allies as well. And I think this is a huge issue in that you've brought up foreign conflict and the problem of many of the recent conflicts, most noticeably the global war on terror and how that ended. And what does that do to, you know, force cohesiveness or, you know, civil society? But you also look at the consequences of inequality and the consequences of QE and domestic social stability. And this is something that has also been a huge focus of mine, in that national power must be predicated on social stability. And how are you going to ensure that you're obtaining that and attaining that at home? And if you look at recruitment numbers all across the West, you're seeing a complete drop in recruitment numbers. Retention numbers as well are trying. So, you know, what does that do to feeling a force capable of responding, let alone the decisions within the power centers on whether to intervene or not. All that said, I'm not painting a clear picture, but I think it's extremely opaque and it's going to be very challenging going forward, because there will be, without a doubt, situations where we will have to respond. Taiwan as a conflict center, the winds will show.
I mean, this is why this peaceful reunification scenario is so worrisome to me, because politically, you can see how the political winds will blow and people say, why should we get involved? They want to be together. You know, let them. They've been split since 1949, but they want to be together. But the geopolitical ramifications on the entire world make it, I think, a very, very different situation than, say, pulling out of Afghanistan, or even, dare I say, this current Russia-Ukraine conflict, because you're talking about that nexus that you brought up, Grant, the geopolitical plus economic nexus all in one here. And you just have to wonder what the knock-on effects on not just supply chains, but you think about what does that do to stability in that entire region? What does it do to Japan, Australia, Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam? So
let's bring this back to the paper that you presented, and let's talk to the extent that you can about the reaction to it. And I guess perhaps more interestingly, the specific questions that were asked when you presented. So if you could lay out the kind of framework that you presented at that seminar, and then let's get into the response and the kind of questions that were being asked and where the kind of issues are that people are kind of grappling with.
I'll go first. I want to talk about energy policy, the inconsistency that we have between, say, CHIPS policy and energy policy. So, you know, remember the three economic pillars of national power that we delved into are geography, natural resources, and industrial capacity. The United States is really blessed on the first two, certainly on geography with its oceanic buffers and river systems and two friendly buffer states of north and south, et cetera. And then we have incredible amounts of arable land relative to population. We're currently the largest producer of oil. So we're naturally long food and energy. But in a way, because of our free market federalist system, we've allowed our industrial capacity to get frittered away. So we compare the chips industry and the oil industry, where in the area of semiconductors, finally, there seems to be, you know, if there's one thing that's uniting this country, it's that China is a threat. And so this CHIPS Act that was passed, and also some of the export controls that were put on China in the area of chips, are a belated but welcome recognition by the government that we need to do something to A, shore up our flank on the industrial capacity side of things and try to choke off certain areas in the critical path for development of advanced semiconductors. So that's all great. But then when you compare and contrast, I would say that we're shooting ourselves in the foot with energy policy because we are believing too much in what I call the Gretaverse and the swing to ESG and not at all hedging ourselves in an area where we have big, tremendous natural resources, which is the traditional hydrocarbon industry. It's my belief that we're going to need all fuel sources, including hydrocarbons, and to willingly gut our SPR, to willingly take Keystone off the map. The reason why Keystone is important also is because our refining network is still from the 70s that require heavier grades of oil. Shale produces light grades of oil. So when people talk about how we're net exporting so many barrels and how we're energy independent, there's a very, very big nuance that industry outsiders miss. That is, if you actually put a ban on exports, it would tank domestic oil prices. But gasoline prices, which are the most important to the consumer, actually spike because we would have to start importing gasoline and heavier grades of crude from the Middle East because that's what we have to do. So there are all these things that are inconsistent about our energy policy. Mike, you want to talk about that? Because that you actually started this conversation about how, right, when you were in the Middle East, you came face to face with just how important this was. But why is our government, why is our federal government, why is one hand not talking to the other here?
Yeah, great question. I ask myself that a number of times a day. But there's still a conflict going within every state waiting for the U.S. to really decide on how it approaches this. And, you know, where do traditional allies fall? I think you see it in every discussion. What is GPC? Is it a great power competition? Is it a great power conflict? Is it a great power challenge? Is it a great power charade? There's still this discussion on, you know, what does this actually mean? And tragically, the ship of state takes a long time to turn. And the risks of turning too hard are also catastrophic domestically. And I don't think we do enough risk assessment on, you know, what does a quote unquote Russian collapse or what does a Chinese collapse? I hear many of the doomsayers saying, actually, you know, some of the best case scenarios presented is that we just have to wait for China to implode. I don't know if that scares me more than great power conflict. You know, pick your risk as far as, you know, a military plan on, you know, what does the planning look like? I'll get back to your point on oil in a minute, but the issue of just throwing money or a Marshall Plan together doesn't cut it if we're talking about, you know, conflicts of this magnitude. When we're talking about something of the order of magnitude as a monetary policy, Malacca Strait dilemma, Taiwan, we're dealing with levers that we don't know where it's going to be pulled. And when I looked at the impact of a closure of the Straits of Hormuz and gas prices that would, you know, simply shoot up, and now we're pulling these very interesting policies domestically in the hopes and dreams of a, you know, an electric utopia. It's very odd. I don't understand it. But one of the kindest remarks we got on the paper was Michael Pettis, which was just a huge compliment of him having read it and, you know, reflected on it. But I had to come back to his book. We're in sort of a version of a class war right now. And we've typically thought of the military as, you know, they will fight the wars and they will insulate the domestic civilian population. But Mike, you brought up the fact that the levers of power now are, you know, forcing inflation through oil and gas, commodities, production. And how are we interpreting and how are we going to react to those levers of power pulled on us if we don't sort out our own domestic production, oil and gas policies, and being, you know, very coordinated, not simply as a markets issue, but a national security issue. You know, we've had the Germans coming to Canada desperate for gas, as well as the Japanese in Canada. And, you know, I think this goes across the board. That all to say is, I don't think we really know what type of conflict competition we're in right now. And I can only imagine that this is going to lead to a lot more volatility and instability going forward.
I just want to comment a little bit more on the oil and gas part, because over the weekend, I've been working on this update to my oil thoughts and trying to distill this conversation I had with the management team of this oil and gas company that I'm invested in. And the idea is, one of the pushbacks that we got on our paper, I believe, was we're going to be energy independent. If it weren't for COVID, we'd be producing 15 million barrels per day. And this is coming from smart, but I will say misinformed person to the oil and gas industry. So we are currently producing about 12.5 million barrels per day. That makes us the largest producer in the world. But here's the problem. The Permian Basin accounts for almost two-thirds of that production, right? The Permian Basin is the only basin left in U.S. shale that is still growing. Everything else is already in decline. They peaked between 2016 and 2019, and some basins like the Eagle Ford are off 60% from peak. Now, the other anecdote I'll share with you is that from 2013 to now, the Permian Basin went from producing 1 million barrels per day to the current 5.7 million barrels per day. It net added close to 5 million barrels per day. Now, think about this for a second. Global base decline, the world consumes, estimates are 101 to 102 million barrels per day, and also obviously produces that much because supply and demand have to balance. Global decline for the last 20 years has been roughly close to about 5 million barrels per day. So for the last 10 years, during the most undisciplined period of shale development, the Permian added the equivalent of just 1 year's worth of global base decline. And so this notion that we are going to remain energy independent forever, and therefore we can just completely gut our SPR and not hedge ourselves in that area, I think is going to lead to serious problems down the road. But I will say, though, that as scary as that is, it's much, much scarier for China, because China actually imports 80 to 90% of its oil and all of it through the Strait of Malacca, and they have no domestic production. So we haven't even seen the world where we have true conflict over scarce resources yet. And that's what I worry about.
If I was a military strategist, which thank God for everybody in this conversation and beyond, I'm not. And I was looking for the perfect way to describe absolutely what not to do if I was in the United States position, I would say you do not want to deplete your strategic petroleum reserve. You do not want to not only give a good reason, but force both the Saudis and the Russians towards the Chinese. They are the three things that you absolutely do not want to do. And yet here we are, we find ourselves doing all three. And this brings me to a question that MSP, I'm fascinated about, because there's often this kind of idea for those of us outside your world that the military is basically given its marching orders by the administration, by the bureaucracy, by the government, here's what you do. And yet we have this sense that in amongst the military, there are far shrewder tacticians than you're going to find in most forms of government. And I read and I pick up anecdotal pieces of information here and there that there is a sense that the military has a very strong and rising voice in this discussion. And they're starting to become more forceful about, you cannot do this. And while it's fine having dreams of, as you said, this electric utopia, and we are going to be, you know, net zero by 2030 or whatever it is, this idea of picking a number out of your head and then enforcing it upon a population is such, I mean, it's so absurd to me. I can't even get my head around how absurd it is. But let's leave that to one side. Have we reached a point where the military are starting to get more vociferous and say, hey, shake the politicians by the collars and say, what you're doing is not only dumb, it's potentially devastating, not just to the US, but let's talk about the West as a whole.
Well, I'm thankful that at my current rank level and in my studies, I only have to do so academically, and I try my best to articulate that politely enough. And God bless those generals and admirals that need to make the case at the table. But this is one of the beauties and one of the struggles of democracy, is that we will take the orders, but having, you know, met a number of brilliant American officers or British or otherwise, you know, some of the best will try and provide the best advice to government possible. And then it is over to the politician to try and do so and balance the interests. I think there is a shift. It is slow. But, you know, this is one of the struggles in the West, I think, we're having, is, you know, this battle between values and interests. And we like to impose values abroad that may not be obtainable at the risk of lots of blood and treasure. And it's not always pretty trying to separate what to do best for your own domestic values and your own democracy and how that is expressed abroad. That is coming to a head rapidly. I think there's going to be some serious choices that need to be made on how to balance this more effectively. And hey, let's be honest, no one's a fan of journalists being dismembered in foreign embassies. How you govern your foreign policy for the betterment of, you know, regional stability and your own domestic social stability and fluid markets, that's a tough conversation. Not very popular right now, but we'll see. These are tough calls, but the risks, as we put this decision off, it's only going to get worse.
But that, Michael, you've written a lot lately about the energy market and inflation. You wrote a piece called Squid Game recently, which was, I thought, was superb. And you talked about inflation, Fed hikes, and you talked about the OPEC plus cut and what all of this does in terms of giving China the ability and maybe in the need to devalue further and what that would wreak upon the world. So can you run us through that logic? Because I think there's a lot in there to unpack within the context of this conversation too.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I think it's four key bullets that I try to make in that piece. Number one is that after 10 rate hikes, the Fed is still hawkish, which is pretty incredible, right? Because core inflation is just proving to be very, very sticky. And if you look at the components of core, they are primarily shelter and labor. And I would say that there are structural impediments to both of those components going down rapidly. So the Fed is, I'm not surprised at all that they are still hawkish. So that's observation one. Observation two is that I think that the OPEC, by the way, cut once already in October. A lot of people don't remember that because a lot of that was symbolic, but there was still a net reduction of barrels. The surprise cut came in April. And I think that's premature. I say it's premature from the standpoint of being an oil investor and looking at the standpoint from OPEC, in that because the Fed is still hawkish, they're kind of wasting their bullets here. I think of the Fed as the central bank for money, for dollars, and OPEC plus as the central bank for oil. I think the central bank for dollars is more powerful ultimately, and they are wasting bullets here before the Fed is done. The third thing is that when you look at the quandary that the PBOC finds itself in, I like to always go back to the Odysseus legend of him trying to steer through the Strait of Scylla and Charybdis. So if Odysseus is the PBOC in that quandary, the Scylla monster is a weak Chinese yuan. Because global commodities are dollar-based, if oil was spiking at the same time that the dollar was spiking against the yuan, so a weak yuan, China imports inflation. And also, to the extent that they have dollar-based debt, a lot of their One Belt, One Road debt is dollar-based. That could also set off their debt bomb. The other side of the monster, the Charybdis monster, is what would happen if the yuan were strong. China, as we all know, is a investment growth-driven economy. They don't have much of a consumer economy, so they're very reliant on exports. So a strong yuan makes it very, very tough for them to compete in the export arena, especially when their target customers, i.e. the West, are starting to go into a global slowdown. So the final observation here is that because demand in Asia is so weak, and ultimately the Fed, I think, is going to be stronger than OPEC, oil prices have not held despite two OPEC cuts. And so lower oil, ceteris paribus, means that Scylla monster, the Scylla monster weaker yuan, is not as scary to the PBOC. I think they need to devalue to basically jumpstart their export sector. The final point I just want to make here is that, again, going back to the interplay of geopolitics and macro, OPEC Plus itself, I think, is a geopolitical actor now. I tweeted earlier out this week a chart of the components of CPI. In the very beginning in 2022, most of the inflation was energy inflation. And that's obviously moderated. But now almost all of the inflation is coming from the stickier labor and shelter components. What do you think will happen once overall CPI starts rolling over? I bet the Saudis will then orchestrate another well-timed cut to basically expand that energy component of CPI once again and essentially keep Fed policy tighter for longer.
This brings us right back where we were, right? This is exactly the problem here. You forced the Saudis and the Russians together. They're both the two biggest members of OPEC Plus. And ultimately, we've reached the point where there has been for 50 plus years this arrangement between the US and the Saudis. Each side knew what their half of the bargain was. You know, the Saudis, it was to buy treasuries with their oil proceeds and reinvest them into there and hold the treasuries. In the US, it was provide security. And suddenly, we're in a very, very different world, and it's kind of crept up on us, but we're in it now. And I call it
a geopolitical mosh pit. It's an every man for himself dynamic.
And exactly
this,
right.
This is one of the reasons why the BRICS situation, and some people are saying, well, what if the Saudis join BRICS? Well, in this scenario that I'm painting, the biggest loser isn't the U.S., who's the largest producer of naturally long oil. It's actually China. So when you talk about Kingdom of Saudi Arabia getting chummy with China, I'm not so sure that their incentives are aligned.
How so? Develop that for us.
Well, because higher oil prices, right, are a big, big problem for China ultimately, because they're naturally short oil and oil is dollar denominated.
Right. But at the same time, you've got an enormous amount of pricing ability with the Saudi oil. I mean, the cost of that stuff to come out of the ground is far below most other players. You've also got a similar situation in Russia. I mean, the infrastructure is more of a problem there in terms of its age and its general decrepitness. But if you are in the supply side of that, and if you have got two big suppliers cozying up to the biggest buyer of oil, there are deals that can be struck for a period of time that would allow them, one would think, to each achieve their aims, or at least each walk away from the table mildly unhappy, but in a slightly better off position than they had been had they had terms dictated by the US, no?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia and Russia are both not happy necessarily that China has been the biggest beneficiary of buying cheap oil because it directly hurts their bottom lines. So you consider that there's an economic mismatch in terms of incentives. But then when you talk about, well, what about the scenario that they do a deal directly in yuan, right? And I always come back to this whole discussion that we're having about the inherent instability of the yuan and why it can't supplant the US dollar. I use this Amazon credit analogy. If you're MBS, and MBS is a smart cookie, he has to be thinking like this. If you get a $50 refund from buying something on Amazon, you're probably going to be okay with keeping that as an Amazon credit. But what if it's a $10,000 refund? You're going to want your cash back. And so from his standpoint, yes, China is his biggest customer. And if she wants to have like a headline about thinking about doing deals directly in yuan, he's going to give him that headline. But when push comes to shove, is he going to convert his U.S. Treasury reserves to Chinese bond reserves that with a closed capital account and potentially subject to a major devaluation? I don't think so. I think he's way too smart for that.
I agree. And that's where this idea of a neutral reserve asset is so important. And the Treasury bonds have always been that neutral reserve asset, even though they weren't necessarily neutral. They were certainly a reliable reserve asset. You know, and this is perhaps a part of the conversation that we can explore the next time the three of us chat, and that's gold's role in all this, because before Treasury bonds, gold was the neutral reserve asset, and we've seen a remarkable uptick in central bank accumulation of gold reserves ever since that move by the Treasury to freeze those Russian reserves. So clearly that's something that's on the minds of people managing official reserve stores. And I just wonder, I've not converted yuan to gold and taking the gold out via the Shanghai Exchange, but people in Asia tell me it's absolutely doable. Now, in what size, I don't know. But again, for me, it's more a case of what's being put in place that could expand in the future. What are people trying? What are they doing in small size with a view to seeing if we need to scale it up, can we? Because at this point, once the world's reserve currency is weaponized, you need to have multiple fallback scenarios as to how you will react if that weaponization is pointed directly at you. You know, it's been pointed directly at Russia, but what if it gets pointed directly at the Saudis? What if it gets pointed directly at any country that holds significant dollar reserves? So I think there's another leg to this conversation that hopefully the three of us can explore the next time we chat. MSP, any closing thoughts before we wrap this up?
No, I think that captured everything. And I'm glad you raised that final issue in that, you know, if we are indeed in a great power conflict or competition, then all options should be on the table, and having that sort of flexibility of mind to look at the worst case scenario. And I think that would be a worst case scenario for everyone, because it's not going to be pleasant for anyone. But for national security professionals, I think, you know, looking at the alternative is important. Either way, the risks abound. Until next time.
MSP, will there ever be an Asian NATO?
Oh, that's how many hours you got? I mean,
yeah. There's another podcast right there.
Right, there you go.
Mike, let me ask you one more question, MSP, and that is about the attitude to this. Because sometimes, particularly when you come from a position of enormous strength, which is what the West has been in for a long time now, it takes a long time for the attitude to show. There's generally the initial reaction to any of this is, yeah, it's rooted in the past. It's, well, yeah, but they're not going to challenge us. Are you seeing any change in the willingness to engage on these topics of people, or is there still a degree of, yeah, it's highly unlikely, I mean, we shouldn't really worry about it too much?
From my observations, I think that there is a struggle in that. For 20 years, most military professionals have been focused on the Middle East, and without a doubt, the Middle East going forward is still going to be extremely important. But in general, how do you go through a phase shift like this when in most military professionals' lifetimes, there may be some faint memory of winning the Cold War? And it has been one wonderful ride up, despite where things go forward. I find it unfortunate when my colleagues in the US always refer to winning and losing, or sports analogies for the military. What if this isn't about winning and losing? What if this is something far more complicated and nuanced? And I can't say that there's an appreciation for the level of change that we're witnessing right now. Those that would have been cold warriors would understand the historical parallels. But when you're smashing together multiple historical parallels on, you know, every front from, you know, finance, macro, geopol, strat studies, I would say we're not there yet. I think we've only just appreciated, and we're at the front end of massive change. And, you know, it's happening slowly, but I think we've got a lot more self-discovery to do to be prepared for what's coming.
All right. That's a perfect way to wrap it up. Michael, thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time. We know you're a busy guy and you've got a lot more important things to do than the two of us do, that's for sure. So again, thank you for that. And I look forward to the next time the three of us can get together and noodle this around, because I think it's just such a fascinating topic.
Thanks, gents. Great pleasure. Talk soon.
Well, Mike, I've got to say, it was every bit as interesting as I knew it was going to be. And it kind of sets the stage for what I expect and hope will be a fascinating conversation going forwards.
No kidding. I think that MSP was the perfect debut guest for this podcast series, because when you think back on that DIME acronym I used, right? In the diplomatic realm, we have the State Department. In the informational realm, we have the CIA. In the military department, we have the armed forces. Each of those areas seem like they're well coordinated, but why don't we have an economic force that's actually coordinated? And I think this discussion kind of attempts to bridge that gap, or at least tell the audience that this intersection is very, very important in today's world.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to the idea that we haven't needed an economic force. You always need a military, but we haven't needed an economic force for some 70-odd years. But the sooner people wake up and realize that whatever the next conflict is, it's going to involve the world of finance, whether you like it or not, the sooner they wake up to that. And hopefully we can help bring some change and help people listening to this understand what's going on and understand its importance. Well, look, mate, we will do this again in the very near future. Before we disappear, why don't you let people know how they can follow your excellent Substack and your musings on Twitter, because they are absolute required reading in my world.
Oh, thank you, sir. My Twitter handle is just Urban Cowboy with a K-A-O, and urbancowboy.com is a Substack.
There we go. That's easy. That was very, very easy. Well, listen, our thanks to you out there for listening. Michael and I will be back with another thread in this conversation. We have no idea where it's going to go, but we'll be back again soon. In the meantime, thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.